Contain potential.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, an interview with Roger Steffens, a photographer, a pioneering reggae DJ, a leading expert on Bob Marley, an actor and a poet. He'll be giving a talk tonight in Tampa, and we're going to talk with him in just a moment. But first, two listener comments about yesterday's interview with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. Wilkerson has emerged as a major critic of U.S. foreign policy and wasteful military spending. Here's what two listeners had to say.
Yes, Rob. The 11 o'clock Radioactivity Show, absolutely brilliant. One of the best interviews you've ever held with Colonel Wilkerson of Colin Powell's staff, as well as the other fine veterans and lawyers that came on. Thank you so much for this elucidating commentary. It's a wonderful revelation for us all.
This is Art from Largo. Today, you presented a most informative and powerful program involving Lieutenant Colonel Wilkerson and the three veterans dedicated to the well-being of fellow veterans. Rob, your questions were well thought, and their responses most revealing. As citizens of the most powerful country in the world, we would like WMNF to inform us much more of our U.S. Foreign affairs. Thanks, Rob, and WMNF for a very educational program today.
Stop that train, I'm leaving.
Well, there you have two listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. That's music from Bob Marley in the background. Our guest today is Roger Steffens, who has led an amazing life, a life that follows the arc of a lot of baby boomers. Rock and roll, Vietnam, the peace and love answer to the war, psychedelics, reggae, and much, much more. He's a Vietnam veteran, a poet, a pioneering reggae DJ, close friend and biographer of Bob Marley's, an actor and photographer. Some of his photos are on display at the Tampa Museum of Photographic Arts, and he'll be speaking there tonight at 6 p.m. And Roger Steffens, it's an honor to have you here at WMNF. Great to see you.
Thank you so much. And I just had a nice tour of this facility. I've got to tell you, this is one of the most amazing public stations I've ever been in my 75 years. And it's a tribute to the people in Tampa who want responsible radio. And I hope that everybody listening today will support this station every chance you have, because it is unique.
You're a legendary DJ. You were there in Southern California, KCRW, for 10 years doing
the whole decade of the 80s.
Probably the most important reggae show in the entire country, if not the entire world.
Well, we did get syndicated to 130 stations around the world. We were getting fan mail in Urdu and Swahili. I still wonder to this day what they were saying to us.
I want to talk about the exhibit that's here in Tampa that features your photographs, but let's go back a little bit. Mm. And you were born in New York City.
Yep, born in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
All-American boy. In a Jewish hospital called Israel Zion. And so I tell my Rasta friends, don't mess with me, man. I was born in Zion.
And you did radio back then.
My first broadcast was on WVOX in New Rochelle, just north of New York City, in 1961. And my first guest was the great Nigerian pioneer, Babatunde Olatunji, whose album Drums of Passion has never been out of print since 1958.
I think that album is still in our library right now, too. That was a great, that was a real crossover. That was African music.
That broke African music in America.
Here in the U.S., yeah.
And then he established a drum center in Harlem that had tremendous effect for many, many years.
That was your first interview. What was he like?
He was a graduate student at NYU. Excuse me. And he wanted to go back to Nigeria and enter politics. But then he released one of the very first studio albums instead of some ethnographic, groovy little guy going to the Babenzeli Pygmies with his portable tape recorder. We suddenly had a studio album of inspiring African rhythms, Aki Wawa and Kia Kia and all those things. And he was a very thoughtful person. I was friends with him right to the end of his life. Mm. The last time I saw him was at a memorial for Fela Kuti, who was also a friend.
You had a fairly conventional background upbringing. You were raised in a Catholic family.
Yeah. 15 years of Catholic schools. I'm a recovering Catholic. And I was a Goldwater conservative. I worked for William Buckley for a while in New York in 65, voted for Goldwater in 64. And then I got drafted. And my whole life changed. And I got shipped off to Vietnam. And I began to see the lies, the subterfuge. I was trained in the Army in PSYOPs, propaganda warfare. And they trained us at Fort Bragg at the JFK Special Warfare Center with Nazi films.
Nazi films?
Yeah, the first class was the four-hour uncut version of Triumph of the Will, the Nazi film that Leni Riefenstahl made, the Nuremberg Rally. And the last class, 3 weeks later, was a repeat of all 4 hours. And then we were told, emulate this when you go to Vietnam.
Because?
It was the finest propaganda ever made. Hmm. And that was our model.
So you were in PSYOPs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did that mean in Vietnam?
Well, it meant we were the people who littered the country with billions, literally billions of leaflets, winning hearts and minds. And that was a futile effort. And I got to see really deep on the inside how dysfunctional the entire thing was. And it was basically just a way to make money. Everybody was over there to make money. I mean, Fisher Stereo sold $3 million worth of stereos in 1969 in Saigon. So it was a way to punch your ticket in the Army. They only sent you there for a year, so you could jump up a grade, sometimes two. I ended up after 26 months in country as a staff sergeant, an E6, which in a peacetime army sometimes takes 10 or 12 years to get to. Mm. So it was careerism and money.
This is also where you took up photography.
Yeah. I had a rather keen sense of history. My grandfather was a historian, and my mother was very, very interested in history. And so I always had a sense of what was happening around me that was important. I remember General MacArthur being fired by Truman and then getting a huge ticker tape parade on Broadway. Remember that vividly. I remember the whole summer of the Army McCarthy hearings, which I watched every day on television. And I realized when I was being shipped to Vietnam that I was going into something that would be a part of history. So I bought a little Canon camera at the Cholon PX in Saigon when I got there. And 3 months later, the Tet Offensive broke out. And there was a curfew for about 3 weeks. And in front of my hotel barracks in downtown Saigon, there were 52 sewer pipes that hadn't been laid underground yet. And there were families living in each of the sewer pipes.
Why were they living there?
Their houses had been destroyed in the Tet Offensive. Huge swaths of the city were burned to the ground. It looked like Dresden. And I had been reading poetry for a living for a couple of years before that. I did a one-man show called Poetry for People Who Hate Poetry. And it was all living American writers, mostly beatniks, and E.E. Cummings, who I really loved. Too good to ignore. So a lot of the work was in the Midwest, and there was a town, Racine, Wisconsin, where I had spoken two or three times at all the schools. So I was known there. And I wrote a letter to the editor of the Racine newspaper, and they published it along with an editorial urging support from the city, especially from the students who remembered me, to send me food and clothing for the refugees in my immediate neighborhood. And I promised that I would personally distribute this stuff. So that it didn't end up on the black market. 3 weeks later, 2 5-ton trucks pulled into the compound with my mail. And I was the colonel's typist. They were really wasting me.
2 5-ton trucks filled with
10,000 pounds of little bitty packages, all addressed to me with stamps on each of them. And I went into the colonel's office and I said, sir, there's something outside you've got to see. I'm very busy, private. I said, no, colonel, you really have to see this. So he gets up and comes outside, and the mail clerk opened one of these huge steel connexes, and there were packages pouring out with my name on all of them. And he says, well, what the hell's that? And I said, well, that's my mail this morning, sir, and I'm going to have to send it all back. What do you mean? I said, well, I asked my friends to send me some stuff that I could distribute to the refugees, and there's 10,000 pounds of it in there, and I'm so busy typing your letters, I have no time to distribute it. Come into my office. He promoted me to Spec 4, gave me my own Quonset hut, told me I could go anywhere in the country from the DMZ to the Delta and work on any project I thought worthwhile, as long as I took pictures. So he could take the credit. I didn't care. I wasn't a lifer. So I shot over 10,000 frames. I had free film and developing for the next 2 years. I kept extending after my year was up so I could get an early out. So the last 26 months of the 60s, I was in Vietnam. I was in Hue right after the Tet Offensive. That's where they made Full Metal Jacket about, and up on the DMZ and down on in the Delta with the island of the Coconut Monk, which is a whole different story.
I want to ask you about that. This is the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive.
Yeah, January 31st will be the 50th anniversary, and I slept through it.
Why? How did you do that?
Well, there's a story there, Rob. The night before, that would have been the evening of the 30th of January, I was in my barracks on the third floor across from PSYOP's group headquarters, and about a quarter to 12, I was awakened by the sound of gunfire, which just grew and grew and grew and sounded like mortars going off, and it was very, very close, and I just tumbled out of bed and crawled under the mattress. I was so frightened. And I'm lying there under the mattress shivering, and I hear amongst all of this gunfire, children laughing and screaming. So I crawled on my belly out to the balcony, and I looked out on the street. There's hundreds of people on the street hurling firecrackers and cherry bombs at each other. Was I relieved. But the next morning I went outside and there were like piles of, you know, exploded firecracker paper like 2 inches deep on the sidewalk in every direction. And the next night I slept like a baby. I didn't wake up at all during the night. It was a really peaceful sleep. And I got up about 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was really eerie. There was no sounds. And normally that street at 7 o'clock is filled with cyclos and motorcycles and trucks and, you know, a riot of sound, and it was dead silent. So I went out on the balcony and I looked down to the guard post beneath my room, and the guard looks up at me and he's in full battle gear with a steel pot on his head, and he says, "Get your flak jacket on, troop, we're under attack." And I look off, and on the horizon to the north there's this huge column of black smoke, and that's, I found out, the Vietnamese naval headquarters going up in flames. And off to the west, Cholon, the Chinese section of Saigon, there's billows of smoke coming from all over. And that was the beginning of the Tet Offensive. At the time I woke up in the morning, the Saigon, American embassy in Saigon, was being held by Viet Cong. And it took 7 hours to get them out of there. There were 77 provincial capitals and cities and towns throughout the country that were attacked simultaneously that day. And virtually everybody was repulsed, but it was such a propaganda victory for the...
Because they were able to get into the South so easily.
Yeah, yeah. And right into the embassy itself. So they really scored a propaganda coup. That was shortly after General Waste Moreland, as we called him, had said that he could see the light at the end of the tunnel. What he didn't know was that it was an onrushing train heading straight toward him.
We're talking with Roger Steffens, who is a broadcaster. He's probably the world's foremost authority on Bob Marley. He's also a photographer of some note. His collection, Family Acids, several photos from that collection are being shown at the Tampa Museum of Photographic Art. He'll be speaking there tonight at 6 o'clock, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You mentioned a moment ago Peace Island.
Yeah.
I had never heard this story. What's the story of Peace Island in Vietnam?
Well, John Steinbeck's son, John Jr., we called him Johnny, had been a soldier in Vietnam and came back as a civilian to be the liaison to a man called the Coconut Monk. And he was a man who had been trained under the French colonial authority as an engineer in France, and they wanted him to become a colonial functionary for him when he returned. And instead, he became a pacifist, and he lived on a perch on a palm tree like a flagpole sitter for years and attracted a great many followers. And in the early 60s, he was given a kind of sandbar. They called it an island, but it was really a sandbar in the middle of the Mekong River near Mito. And the north bank of the river was controlled by the Americans and the south bank by the communists. And they'd fire rockets and mortars over the island, but they never touched the island. And anybody who came there without a weapon was welcomed, no questions asked. And they would build a house for them. And there were about 2,000 deserters from the North Vietnamese Army, a couple of thousand deserters from the South Vietnamese Army, and a couple of thousand Taoists. And they prayed to Christ, Buddha, Muhammad, Lao Tse, Confucius, Sun Yat-sen, Victor Hugo, and Winston Churchill. And they everything on the island had a double or triple symbolic meaning. They had a huge circular prayer platform at the tip of the island, and every 3 hours, day and night, each of the families would send one representative to the platform to pray for peace. And they had a double bell tower with these six-ton bells that were struck with tree trunks and resounded for miles up and down the river. And those bells were made from melted down American mortar shells.
Wow.
And that was the only place in Vietnam that I ever saw happy people. And they were led by this man who had such a huge influence. And of course, as soon as the war ended, the communists put him in prison, and he died in house arrest in 1991. But you could see statues of Christ shaking hands with Buddha and the Virgin Mary hugging Kuan Yin, the Chinese female deity, and Buddha straddling the world. And it was just like no place I've ever seen in my whole life ever since then.
What happened to your photos of Vietnam?
I've still got them all. I probably shot about 10,000 frames, both black and white and color. And a lot of them are shown on our family asset site now, thanks to my kids.
Okay, and we're going to talk about that exhibit tonight. It's at the Tampa Museum of Photographic Arts. It's going to be there for the next few weeks, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. So when you came back from Vietnam,
I had been known as a conservative, even though I was a hippie, and I was ferociously anti-war in 1970 when I came back. And I was able to speak to an awful lot of people who would never have consciously booked an anti-war speaker. And so all my friends wanted to know what happened to me in Vietnam. And I put together a slideshow with about 300 pictures that I'd taken. And I said, I only want to tell you what I experienced personally. I don't want any hearsay or anything. I want you to know what happened to me and why. And so I was touring with that and also with my poetry show when I got back from Nam. And by the end of April of 1970, all hell broke loose with the Cambodian invasion, and all the schools I'd been booked to speak at were on strike. So instead of being the convocation speaker, I became the strike committee speaker. And some of those were riotous evenings. Sometimes they would last 3 or 4 hours, and the townspeople would come to the facility, and everybody wanted to talk about what was going on, and it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before. I mean, the whole country seemed to be on strike, and I was able to speak to things like the Davenport, Iowa Republican Women's Club and the Lutheran Women's Layman's League and Madison, Wisconsin, and, you know, people that you wouldn't normally think would want to hear an anti-war speaker. But I had a certain credibility because they knew about my politics when I had gone there.
You did some traveling after you came back from Vietnam. You were in North Africa, and eventually you went to Jamaica?
Jamaica was about 6 years after, but most immediately. At the end of 1970, I was so ashamed to be an American, and Nixon was still in office, and Kissinger was bombing Hanoi, and I didn't want to be an American anymore. So I moved to Marrakesh, and I was there. I had a letter of introduction to a countess who lived in a 40-room palace in Marrakesh called the Villa Taylor, which had the largest private cactus garden in North Africa, and her late husband had owned all the Francophone newspapers in Africa, so she was enormously wealthy, the Countess de Breteuil. And her son was pardon me, was a controversial character who showed up the end of the first week of July in 1971 in Marrakesh, telling me that he and his girlfriend, with whom he was traveling, Marianne Faithful, had just left Paris because they found Jim Morrison's body in a bathtub.
Oh, wow.
And they were telling me this story less than 48 hours later, and as the days went by, I began to think that they were making all this up because there was nothing in the paper, there was nothing on Radio Luxembourg. And finally, that following Thursday, the news broke that he was dead and already buried in Père Lachaise. So that was an unnerving experience to hear about that. And, you know, I eventually got tired of not having hot water and a real toilet. And I went to England, and I was sponsored by the National Theatre when an old drama school classmate of mine was the assistant to Sir Larry Olivier, and I spent 3 months in living in Surrey, and nobody ever answered my mail because the address was straight out of The Hobbit, Wayside Cottage, Mincing Lane, Chobham near Woking, it's hyphenated, Surrey. Everybody thought I was making it up, so nobody answered my mail. And then I came back, and I had married a woman I met on the island of the Coconut Monk, Cynthia Coppola, war correspondent from California. And we moved to Berkeley, and I got divorced in 73. And so did my friend Tim Page. Now, Tim Page and I were roommates for 2 years, from 73 to 75 in Berkeley. We'd both gotten divorced in 73. And Tim is the guy that Dennis Hopper played in Apocalypse Now. Tim was the most wounded Vietnam correspondent who survived the war. He was blown up 4 times. The last time, he quite literally had the right third of his brain blown out the back of his head. And he sued Time Life, and they said, oh, you don't need that part of your brain to function anyway, so we won't give you any money.
Wow.
Yeah, and after a year and a half in recovery, he began working in the early 70s for Rolling Stone, for the editor Jan Wenner. And Jan sent Tim out on a couple of assignments with a new fellow he had hired to write for the magazine called Hunter S. Thompson. And after 2 assignments together, Hunter Thompson went to Jan Wenner and said, I can't work with this guy Page anymore. He's too crazy. which Tim wore as a badge of honor, of course. And he used to have a button on his cap that said, drain damaged. He's still alive. He's 73. He lives in Brisbane. He's written and photographed 12 books since then. He's an extraordinary man. If you don't know anything about Tim Page, check him out. His first volume of his autobiography is called Page After Page, and it's one of the best books I've ever read.
All these people that you've mentioned so far, yeah. are you taking pictures of them
as
time's going on? So you've got documents of your time with these people.
Yeah, and then in 74, I met a veteran, and he was in a wheelchair. And in December of 74, I went to visit him at his apartment in Venice Beach in California. And he had about 100 pages typed like Kerouac, from the top left to the bottom right. No, you know, punctuation, not much punctuation. And he was starting to feed it into the fireplace. And I grabbed his hand and I said, wait a minute, what is that? And he says, it's just a bunch of stuff I rattled off. I wanted to get it off my chest. It's all crap. Put it in there. Throw it in the fireplace. And I started to read it. And I went, hey, wait a minute, man. This is good stuff. This is great stuff. You could get this published. Nah, it's crap. I said, what if I found you a publisher? Would you finish writing this? And he says, you think you could find a publisher? I said, absolutely, man. So in January, we flew to New York City and stayed in the Chelsea Hotel, as one does, and made appointments with 8 different publishers. And at the end of the week, we had 3 solid offers, and he took the least offer, and it was from McGraw-Hill. And I said, you could have doubled your money. Why did you do that? Why did you take their offer? And he says, well, when I was out in Massapequa High School, all my damn textbooks were McGraw-Hill, and I'm going to make those bastards pay me now. It was Ron Kovic, and the book was born on the 4th of July.
Wow, wow. So how did you meet? Well, when did you get into reggae? When did you decide that reggae? Because I read that you grew up a rock and roller.
Oh, and, God, and, Alan Freed and all his early shows. I saw Buddy Holly in person, Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, my first rock and roll show, Teenage Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis. I mean, the Alan Freed shows were amazing. It had, I've had like 20 acts for $250. And so I was really a rock and roller first gen. And by the beginning of the 70s, you know, the music business had been conglomeratized and all those great early independent labels had been sucked up. And the music was direct, disco and all that stuff. And like a lot of 60s people, I was very interested in finding some kind of music that had the political commitment of the 60s with the great harmonies of the doo-wop artists. And there was an article in Rolling Stone by a gonzo journalist from Australia named Michael Thomas, who wrote, "Reggae music crawls into your bloodstream like some vampire amoeba from the psychic rapids of Upper Niger consciousness." And I said, man, I don't know what that means, but I got to find it. And I was living in Berkeley, so I went out and I found a used copy of Catch a Fire, Bob Marley's first international album. And my life changed forever. And the next night I saw The Harder They Come in a little tiny theater on the north side of the Berkeley campus. And when the spliff scene came on, everybody in the theater lit up and you could hardly see the screen for the smoke. And I bought the soundtrack for The Harder They Come on the way home. And I've been on a reggae trot ever since. I went to Jamaica for the first time with my new wife, Mary, who I met on an acid trip in a pygmy forest in Mendocino under a total eclipse of the moon on Tim Page's birthday in 75. And we wanted to go and find all the records I'd been reading about and couldn't find in the States. And we arrived the week that Prime Minister Manley, the socialist, declared a national state of emergency, said there was an imminent invasion from America, and threw the opposition in jail with no charges, and they had tanks on the street corners. I thought I was back in Saigon in the Tet Offensive. I just wanted to go buy records. And we went to Bob Marley's record shack. Everybody said, don't go to Kingston, but we had to. And we got there, and the streets were empty, and it was really foreboding. And then there was a little back street where Bob Marley had a tiny record shack about the size of two telephone booths. And we went inside, and there was a guy behind a little board. And I said, let me see all your Bob Marley records. And he says, we don't got none. I said, how about Peter Tosh? We don't got none. And I went out, and I looked at the sign, and there's Bob's label and Peter's label. And I went back in, and I said, how about Bunny Wailer, the third of the Wailers? And he had two records by him. And all of a sudden, I look down, and there's a hand in my right-hand pants pocket. And it's not mine. And I had $400 that I had saved up for a year to buy records in cash in that pocket. And I grabbed this guy's wrist so hard, I must have stopped the blood circulating. And he had to let go. And he pulls his hand out, and it's like 104 degrees in Kingston. And he's got a three-piece black suit on, and the pant leg is almost halfway up his leg. And he opens up his jacket, and he pulls out a 45 record called Jaja, a hymn to God. And he says, buy my record. I said, that's you on that record? Yeah, man, buy my record. So I got off for $1.25 instead of $400, but that was my entrance to Jamaica. That taught me a lot right away. And then we got, half hour later, we met someone who took us to Jimmy Cliff's house. And I spent the afternoon with him and Chynna Smith and Joe Higgs, the father of reggae music, and they couldn't have been nicer to us. So, you know, heaven and hell all in one afternoon.
When did you actually meet Bob Marley?
I met Bob Marley in 78. I was taken backstage at a show in Santa Cruz, California, by his lead guitarist, Junior Marvin. And that day, I had a poster someone was handing out in line to promote a show three nights later in Berkeley at the Greek Theater. So Junior said, why don't you ask Bob to sign your poster? And went over and he introduced me to Bob. And Bob was well-irie, let's put it that way. And there was no conversation imminent there. But he did sign the poster, and so did the band. And then over the next 14 years, another, well, a total of 40 people signed it on the front and back. And when I loaned it to the Grammy Museum a couple of years ago, they insured that poster for $75,000.
Wow. Who else signed it?
Oh, the whole band, his family, Chris Blackwell, the Mafia guy, Danny Sims, his art director, his best friend, his damager, I mean his manager.
His whole posse.
The whole posse, yeah, yeah.
You brought some rare unreleased of Bob Marley. Let's listen to one. Set this up for us. What are we about to hear?
Well, on his last album, he did a great song called One Drop. Feel it in the One Drop, that heartbeat rhythm. That's reggae music's secret weapon. The beat of reggae is the beat of the healthy human heart at rest.
Talk about that for a moment. You trace the history of reggae. You go back to ska and relate ska's beat to the heartbeat, too. Could you tell that story?
They're all heartbeat rhythms, but at different tempos, if you listen to the music. Pum, 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 that's ska. And then rocksteady came in for a brief 2 years, 66 to 68. Ba-boom, boom, ba-boom, boom, ba-boom, boom. And then reggae, chaka, chaka, chaka. So it is all based on the heart. It's the music you hear in the womb. That's why babies love it, and dogs. it is a music that has as its root purpose the raising of human consciousness. And it is irresistible, and people all over the world respond in the same way to it, even when they can't understand the lyrics. And Summer, the lady who was just on, was telling me that in Egypt, Bob Marley was hugely popular, especially in the 80s, because the people there knew that he was a rebel, and that especially young people, and the fact that he embraces cannabis as a sacrament. And he always said, you must not misuse this. This is to raise you to a higher level of overstanding. He told a writer friend of mine named Vivian Goldman one day, she took him back to her apartment in London in 1977 when he was there making Exodus. And Vivian said that day Bob Marley paid her the greatest compliment of her life. He said, "You know, Vivian, you don't have to smoke herb all the time."
Let's listen to this version.
This is an unreleased outro to the One Drop song where Bob does a great scat. Yeah, Bob Marley. Not bad, huh?
That's really great. I didn't know he could scat. I should just say to our listeners, Roger Steffens is live in the studio. He's going to be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Tampa Museum of Photographic Arts in downtown Tampa. And he starts the talk at 6 o'clock. Roger is perhaps the world's foremost expert on Bob Marley.
But bear in mind that an expert is just somebody from out of town.
And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. So what kind of guy was Bob Marley? How would you describe him?
Dreadly serious. I mean, he did enjoy a laugh, but I remember Garth Dennis, one of the members of the quartet Wailing Souls, who were trained in the same yard in Trenchtown with Joe Higgs, the father of reggae music. And one day in 1976, when Bob had finally broken through internationally, Garth came to visit him at Tuff Gong, his headquarters in Kingston. And Bob said, "How you doing, Garthy? What's up? What you doing?" And he says, "Oh, nothing much." And Bob said, "In these times?" You know, he had a mission. He had a mission, and the mission was to tell the world that God Almighty was incarnate and a living man in our time, in this Iowa, in this hour, and that was Haile Selassie. And Haile Selassie was the fulfillment of the biblical prophecy that when Christ returned to earth, it would no longer be as a lamb to the slaughter, but in his kingly character as King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. And Selassie could trace his lineage all the way back to Solomon. And he recognized Selassie as the incarnation of that biblical prophecy because his nobleman's name before he became emperor was Ras Tafari, which meant head creator. So the Rastaman would say, "So who create the head? It must be God." And then when he took the title of emperor, he added that he was the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, and conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. So prophecy fulfilled. There had been street preachers beginning as early as 1912 predicting the return of a black king to Africa, which would say that the day of deliverance is near. So he was heavily influenced by Rastafari. His main mission in life was to spread that word, and everything else, the soccer, the music, the women, they were all secondary to that. He was here for a purpose.
And this is all based on their reading of the Bible.
Yeah. And he was psychic. You know, Bob was definitely psychic. I had so many people when I was writing my new book, So Much Things to Say, The Oral History of Bob Marley, which came out last summer from Norton. I interviewed several people who had unnerving experiences with Bob. There was a writer named, I think it's Gregory Philip, a Jamaican writer, who said Bob... he ran into Bob at the University of the West Indies, and Bob sat down next to him and began telling this guy his life story. Somebody he'd never met before.
Wow.
When he was 3.5 years of age, he would read the hands of the people in his little village of Nine Mile, and they would come to his mother and say, "Hey, well, you've got to keep an eye on this kid. There's something really strong going on about him. How could he know these things about my personal life, telling me these intimate details?" And then... his mother married a man in Delaware, and in the summer, that Woodstock summer of 1969, Bob spent that summer with his mother there in Wilmington, and he was friends with a couple of local fellows, one of whom, Ibis Pitts, owned an African arts and crafts store across the street from his mother, Bob's mother's house, and they were talking to Bob, Ibis, and his friend Dion Wilson one afternoon, and they were saying, "Oh, Bob, you know, you're going to be a big star. You're going to have a long life, lots of money, and big success." And Bob looked at him, and he was 24 at the time, and he says, "No, man." He says, "When I'm 36, I'm going to die."
And he did.
And he did.
We're talking with Roger Steffens, who will be speaking tonight at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts. I keep saying another word, but it's the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts. It's on North Ashley Drive right there at Kennedy. Roger Steffens is perhaps the world's leading expert on Bob Marley, but he's also a fantastic photographer, and he's got quite a history, too. He's an actor. He's a poet. He did a reggae show in Southern California for many years and is probably one of the most in-demand speakers at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
I was the first speaker there. And the first song performed inside the Hall of Fame was by my friends Loose Caboose, a reggae band from Massachusetts, and they sang Rastaman Chant on the stage of the Hall of Fame to break that place in. But I'm the most frequent speaker there, too. I've done 9 shows.
Just going back to Bob Marley for a little bit. He grew up on the streets, right? I mean,
yeah, he was. You know, that movie that came out a few years ago called Marley, Kevin MacDonald made. It was a good flick, but it left out some very important things in his life. And the most important, because the movie was about the rejection in Bob's life by both white and black people. Even his black grandmother called him the little German boy, because his father was a white man. And when he was 5 years old, his father showed up at the village. Because he never really knew the father. The father was 64 years of age when Bob was born, and his mother was 18. Mm. He was a dirty old man. He was abandoned by he was rejected from his own Marley family. So The father shows up in the village and says, let me have the boy, I'll bring him to Kingston and I'll enroll him in a good school and we'll give him a shot at a better life. And reluctantly, his mother, Sadella, gave the boy to the father and they went off on a minibus to Kingston. And the father abandoned him, sent him to live with an old woman who was dying. So from the ages of 5 to 7, Bob Marley was essentially an abandoned child on the streets of Kingston. And you can go one of two ways. You can go real bad, real fast, just to survive, or you can do what Bob did, which was to develop that empathy for the sufferers, for the people through no fault of their own who were born poor. And that informed his lyrics for the rest of his life, that incredible empathy he had for the impoverished people, for the people who had no hope in life.
Bob made a lot of money. I mean,
they said he made $30 million during his life, but he gave almost all of that away. He supported, according to Colin Leslie, who was his business manager, who had to sign the checks and knew better than anybody where Bob's money went. He said Bob Marley supported as many as 6,000 people every single month. And people would line up, and I have several stories and so much things to say about this from eyewitnesses, where people would line up blocks long waiting to come into Bob's office and beg them for help. A farmer whose tractor broke and couldn't bring in his crops, Bob would buy him a tractor. In fact, one day, Colin said, a guy came in with a plan to start a coconut oil company, and Bob wrote him a big check right away. And when he left, Colin said, Bob, why did you do that? And Bob says, oh, Colin, he says, I've always wanted to be in the oil business.
What was your sense of Bob's politics? What did he think politically?
He didn't want to be involved in politics. Excuse me. He eschewed politics. I had a problem. I worked for many years on a now aborted autobiography with Bunny Wailer. And in 70 and early 71, the Wailers were on something called the PNP bandwagon. PNP was the People's National Party, the party of the socialist Michael Manley, who was running for office. And they went all over the island with musical acts, and they would sing, and a crowd would gather, and then Michael Manley would come out and make a political speech. And I said to Bunny, so you supported Manley? And he says, no man. We never support no man. I said, but how can you say that? I mean, you sang and gathered the crowd for him. He says, yeah, man, but the only reason we did that was he paid us more money than anybody had ever paid us. He gave us $150 a night. I think he's being a little ingenuous. They had a lot of hope that Manley would come in and really shake things up, that he would legalize marijuana, which he kind of hinted at privately, and he didn't do anything of the sort. So they really felt abandoned by him. They were very upset. And that's where the famous line, never make a politician grant you a favor. He would only want to control you forever. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, it was politics that got Bob shot in 76. I mean, everybody wants to know who shot Bob Marley.
Who did attempt that assassination?
Well, I know exactly who did it, and I know the name of the guy, but I couldn't publish it because 42 years later, it's still volatile.
Was it because Manley, that Marley was supporting Manley?
It appeared as if Bob was offering support to Manley because Bob wanted to do a free show for the people in Jamaica after he had become this huge international star, and he wanted to do something locally for his people. And he didn't want it to appear to be political in any way. And the Manley's government announced that he was going to do a show on the prime minister's lawn. And Bob said, I never agreed to do anything like that. No, we're not going to do it. So after a long conference with Manley, Manley offered him Heroes Park Circle outside the National Stadium and said it would not be in any way a political event, and then announced that national elections would be held 10 days after the concert. Mm. And by appearing on the same stage with Bob Marley at that concert, it would certainly appear to the public that Bob was endorsing Manley's re-election. So he became the object of death threats from the Jamaican Labor Party, the right-wing party of Edward Seaga, who they used to call Edward Seaga. And to two nights before the concert, Bob was rehearsing in his studio in Kingston, and six or seven gunmen drove straight through the gate, shot Bob Marley's wife, who was driving out at the time, shot her in the head. And Bob was in the kitchen peeling a breadfruit, and the gunman came in and turned to his left and shot Bob's manager five times in the groin, and turned around and shot Bob with a bullet that came right across Bob's heart and lodged in his left arm, and he went to the grave with that bullet in him. And luckily he escaped, and two nights later Bob headlined the so-called Smile Jamaica concert.
He played the concert.
And that was one of the most, that is the most amazing moment in 20th century popular music history. His wife was in the hospital with a bullet lodged in her skull, and they told her it wasn't operable and she shouldn't move. And that was a Friday night when they were all shot. Bob went into hiding at Chris Blackwell, the owner of Island Records, home in the hills above Kingston. And people came up there and begged him not to do the show. And they said, the gunman will come back. You're going to be outdoors. It'll be nighttime. They'll have cover. They'll come back to finish you off. Please don't do the show. And there was a young man named Jeff Walker who had been Bob's publicist at Island Records in the States. And Bob said, I'm not going down there without a weapon. And Jeff said, Bob, your guitar is your machine gun. And something clicked, and he decided at the last minute that he was going to go. And a car pulls up, and out jumps Rita Marley, who has, according to her, stolen a car from the parking lot of the hospital. And she's there in her hospital gown with a bloody bandage on her head. And Bob grabs her hand and says, come on, baby, we're going to do a show. And down they go, and there's 80,000 people in this big public park waiting to see if Bob's going to show up. And he was going to do one song, but he ended up doing almost an hour and a half. And at the end of it, he goes a cappella, and he holds his hand out in that familiar gesture as if he were holding a grapefruit in his hand. And he says, if puss and dog can get together, what's wrong with you, my brother? Why can't we love one another? And he's standing there with the bullet in his arm, and his wife is singing back up with the bloody bandage on the head and the bullet in her skull. What can you compare that to in pop music history? Woodstock? It rained at Woodstock. People got mud on their shoes. I mean, that to me is an incomparable moment. And that was the night that Bob went from showman to shaman.
We're talking with Roger Steffens, who has done an oral history of Bob Marley called So Much Things to Say. Also, his book, his collection of photographs, part of that collection, is showing tonight and for the next few weeks at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts on North Ashley Drive in downtown Tampa. Roger is a broadcaster, used to host a reggae show at KCRW in Los Angeles, and he'll be giving a talk tonight at 6 o'clock at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts. I want to jump ahead. There's so much we could talk more about Marley, but you have crossed paths with so many interesting people.
Yeah.
Paul Simon.
Yeah, I'm the guy who turned Paul Simon onto Ladysmith Black Mambazo. I was doing several different shows on KCRW in addition to the reggae beat. I did a show with Tom Schnabel called Morning Goes Makosa. And we had Fela Kuti on with us, and we became friends, and a lot of amazing people, but who'd you just ask me about?
Paul Simon.
Oh, Paul Simon, yeah. So the head of Warner Brothers Records, Lenny Waronker, called me in 1983, and he said, we just signed Paul Simon to Warner's, and he's interested in doing something with African music. Can you send him some stuff? And I sent him a couple of albums I had by Ladysmith, and he called me up. We ended up talking for about an hour and a half. We were the same age. We were both raised in New York. We figured we were at the same Alan Freed shows. And he's quite an extraordinary guy. I think he did as much to help hasten the end of apartheid as almost anybody.
Because he took some criticism for that album.
Yeah, but all the South African artists who played on it realized that this was a much more positive thing than telling him, no, you can't come here and record.
Keith Richards.
Oh, yeah, Keith Richards went to Jamaica in 72. 2, I think it was, to make goat's head soup and fell in love with the place and bought a house on the north coast near Ocho Rios. And we have a lot of mutual friends, and I've always wanted to show him the archives, which fill 7 rooms of my house in L.A. And he finally came in 2010. He had done an album in his living room with the great Justin Hines of the Dominoes. And when he moved to Jamaica, he used to hang out at the beach below his house, and there were a bunch of fishermen there. And now, this is a guy who was born in 43. He knew the ska era in England. He knew about Jimmy Cliff and Laurel Aitken and Justin Hines and the Dominoes and Jimmy Cliff, all these people. So he comes to Jamaica, and he starts hanging on the beach with a bunch of fishermen. And, Ross Headful and Sister Maureen and Justin the Fisherman and Ross this and Jaw that. And there's a lot of singing going on. And so he invites him back to his house. And eventually they get so comfortable with him that they bring the sacred Nyabingi Rasta drums down to his house for safekeeping. And he starts recording these sessions. And in 1995, he released an album from his living room called Wingless Angels. And then about 7 years later, he did another album in a studio. And that was going to be called Wingless Angels 2. And he wanted to release it as a box set, but a very swanky $250 wooden box, which would have an autographed sketch that he did inside it, and a big booklet with an interview, and a DVD also. And he wanted me to conduct the interview with him for the DVD. So he came to my house. We had to be vetted before he came. His manager and his bodyguard came to check out the entire house. He had to have a cool-out room. And so he showed up, and we had an hour-long interview and a tour of the place. And it turns out that he was singing with these people for about 3 years, and finally he said one night to Justin the Fisherman, "You know, you've got a beautiful voice. Have you ever thought about recording?" And Justin says, "I've been recording for 15 years, Keith." He says, "Really? Under what name?" He says, "My own name, Justin Hines." Keith goes, "You're Justin Hines? Why didn't you tell me?" He says, "You never ask." And it's one of the most beautiful records ever, and one of the last vestiges of pure, unadulterated, non-commercial Rastafari religious music, and it'll take your breath away.
We're down to the last 2 minutes or so of the show, and I haven't asked you about where did Family Acid come from, but people can hear it tonight, I think, as you tell
I'll
that
tell
story.
Them. It's a quick story.
Okay.
Our Instagram, created by my kids, is called The Family Acid because my daughter Kate said when she was growing up, all her friends told her that our family was like the Waltons on acid. So the exhibition tonight will be counterculture photography going back over 50 years from various parts of my life, and some people that you will recognize instantly and others that should be recognized. I can't tell you how grateful I am to you, Rob, for having me here today in such a wonderful station. And I do hope that all your listeners will continue to support and keep this station viable. It is crucially important in this time that there is a voice of sanity and moderation.
Well, you are a legend in public radio, not just knowing Bob Marley, but you've got quite a history, and maybe you can come back. Maybe come back and tell some more stories.
I'd love to. Got 75 years worth of them.
Roger Steffens has been our guest. He'll be speaking at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts tonight in downtown Tampa at 6 o'clock. Roger, it's so great to have you here. Thanks for coming by WMNF.
Great pleasure. One love.
One love to you. This is WMNF in Tampa.
Unification of all Rasta man, yeah. As it's been said already, let it be done. I tell you who we are under the sun. We are the children of the Rasta man. Children.
wait.